In little more than a few decades, mindfulness has gone from being a specialist element of Buddhist teaching to the must-have app for celebrities, and businesses use it to reduce staff stress and boost productivity. It's even prescribed on the NHS for anxiety and depression. Emma Barnett now follows the story of mindfulness from its roots in Buddhism to today's multi-billion dollar worldwide industry. Is it a panacea for the ills of modern life, or just another health fad?
It's that time of year again, a time for taking stock, for resolving to live a better, healthier life, to become a nicer, more thoughtful human being. And being 2015, it's a fair bet that someone, somewhere, will suggest that doing a course in mindfulness could be one of the ways that you could achieve those goals. But before you eagerly download that app or sign up for those lunchtime sessions being offered at work, I want you to take a moment. Pause. Because the history of mindfulness is not quite what it seems, and the way it's being used today is raising some difficult questions. Now focus your mind, breathe in deeply through your nose, let it out slowly, and come on a journey with me through mindfulness. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin.
I think we've really hit a tipping point. Suddenly, 2013 and 2014 were the years when CEOs started coming out, not as being gay, but as being people who are seeing the connection between mindfulness and stress reduction and the bottom line.
That's Arianna Huffington, founder of the Huffington Post. Love it or loathe it, it's one of the most visited news sites in the US. Arianna's A-listed celebrity contacts are so legendary, she's been dubbed the Connector. She has few challenges as one of the great chronicles of the zeitgeist and has watched mindfulness grow and grow.
A lot of celebrities, you know, a lot of actors and comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and in the UK, Ruby Wax. So it was both politicians, celebrities, business people. In the UK, we had the Bank of England offering meditation. We had the House of Commons where MPs were doing mindfulness trainings. So we saw the success of Headspace, you know, the meditation app that was launched in the UK first. So that's a huge shift from where we were.
Now, when I started out on this journey through mindfulness, I was probably typical of many people. I'd heard the word bandied all over the place, mindful this, mindful that. There are all sorts of promises of how it could transform my life. In fact, I'd heard it talked about so many times, I didn't really stop to ask what it was. I thought I knew that it had some connections to Buddhism, but beyond that, well, not so much. So let's start with some basics. What actually is mindfulness? One person you should know is former Buddhist monk Andy Puddicombe. He's co-founder of Headspace, arguably the most well-known mindfulness app. Others are available. Since launching in 2010, nearly 2 million people have downloaded Headspace. It's only a relatively new startup, but analysts have already valued the business at around $50 million. Andy talked to me from his home in California.
It's really useful to bear in mind that the mindfulness as we know it in the West, the way it's been sort of translated into a secular language, if you like, comes from the Buddhist tradition. But I do think there's a way of sort of distilling the essence, and that's really to say it's about being present in the moment. So usually the mind is very distracted. We're overwhelmed by our feelings, and many people spend a lot of their time in this state. But when we step out of that, when we learn how to step out of the busyness of the mind and be present in the moment, that is the quality of mindfulness.
So Andy, what is the difference between mindfulness and meditation?
If we think about mindfulness as being present in the moment, our full attention, undistracted, and not being overwhelmed by emotion. So you can apply this to anything, anytime, anywhere. And most of us have experienced these moments in life. Maybe it was, I don't know, skiing down a hill, or maybe it was watching a sunset or listening to some music, watching a child play. But it's that moment where all of the thoughts just kind of fall away. And for that moment, there is just a feeling of being grounded and present where we are. The tricky thing about that is that those moments tend to come and go. So we need an exercise to learn how to be more mindful more of the time. And that's really what meditation is. It's just where we step out of our everyday life and we take a short period of time to allow the mind to be still. And when we do that, as we become kind of more proficient in that, we can then apply that back into everyday life. And we start to experience a greater sense of mindfulness throughout all those activities, no matter what we're doing or where we are.
Now, when you put it that way, it's pretty hard to resist, right? So now I know mindfulness is being present in the moment and that meditation is the way of training the mind to do that. Simple. Or is it? Just got to take that leap and try it.
Right, I'm here in my bedroom. It's 10:30 at night. I've left it probably too late and I'm already feeling a little bit vexed. I've had to do loads of jobs this evening, dinner, washing, tidying, just done my hair for the morning. Anyway, in an attempt to be peaceful, I've come upstairs, locked myself away. I've even lit a scented candle and I have downloaded the Headspace app. Here we go.
Hi, my name's Andy. And over the next 10 days, I'm going to show you a really simple way of getting some more headspace in your life. Now, if you haven't watched the introduction animation yet...
I was trying the 10-day taster session on the Headspace app. By day three, things were still not going well. It was a bit strange having spent time late at night in my bedroom listening to Andy's voice telling me to breathe deeply and then going on to interview him. But I had to confess to him in person my doubts.
Can I be so bold as to ask how old you are?
Yeah, that's right, I'm 29.
Okay, so if we're talking about changing the habitual thought patterns of 29 years, I would say 3 days is quite ambitious. I'm not suggesting that in 10 days your life is going to change. You know, this is a journey of a lifetime, and the 10 days are really like an introduction to people.
Okay, I will keep practicing, I promise. The other question we started with was, where does this mindfulness movement come from? As we've heard, its roots are in Buddhism, and it's often sold explicitly or implicitly as being steeped in the wisdom of an ancient Eastern religion thousands of years old. The reality, though, is much more interesting. Robert Scharf is Professor of Buddhist Studies at the University of Berkeley in California.
I think when we talk about the modern mindfulness movement, most scholars would trace it back to around the turn of the 20th century in Burma. It is interesting how this single moment in Buddhist history has become so important in the modern Buddhist movement. Around that time, there was a monk, Ledi Sayadaw, who was not the only person, but the most influential in trying to make the more technical teachings of Buddhism more accessible to lay people, as well as make meditation more accessible to lay people. Because up until that time, meditation was really seen as something that was really only relevant for monks, and even then a very small percentage of monks. Ledi Sayadaw, he was doing this in part because of the threat of British colonial movement in Burma. There was a real threat that they would lose their sense of themselves as Burmese and their cultural and their religious traditions.
Mindfulness might still have remained a fringe alternative pursuit, a bit like yoga, if it hadn't been for the next crucial step. Some of those Westerners who learned this meditation technique in India during the 1960s and 70s realised it was very powerful indeed. It doesn't require any specialist Buddhist knowledge and can be taught to anyone in 10 to 15 minutes. John Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts Medical School saw the potential for using this mindfulness meditation to help patients deal with chronic pain. In 1979, he launched a program called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. Mindfulness had been officially rebranded. It had finally lost its ties with Buddhism and had crossed over into Western medicine. Professor Robert Scharf.
Kabat-Zinn was very interested in the psychological. He wasn't the only person, but he was perhaps the most successful at completely stripping away what was left of the Buddhist cosmological, the Buddhist ethical, the Buddhist institutional, and the Buddhist doctrinal world. He managed to strip all that away and transform this into what was really a therapeutic technique.
In the UK, the medical use of mindfulness has been pioneered by Mark Williams, Emeritus Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Oxford University and co-founder of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre.
We turned to mindfulness because we knew that some of the talking therapies, such as cognitive therapy, do a pretty good job of preventing depression coming back, but nobody really knew how. Some research was suggesting it's because people begin to change their relationship to their thoughts. But cognitive therapy is designed for people when they are depressed, not for when they're between depressions. But depression is a recurrent problem. It keeps coming back. And so we were looking for something else that would give people that same training to learn to deal differently with their own thinking processes. And mindfulness seemed to us to be a useful potential way forward.
The Mental Health Foundation estimates that 1 in 4 people in the UK will develop a mental health problem each year. NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, backs mindfulness for those with recurring depression, and it's estimated that as many as 30% of GPs presently refer patients for mindfulness-based therapy.
From Britain, it rapidly spread into Europe and Australia and even now Asian countries from where this original practice came are interested in how to apply this 8-week programme for people who are depressed.
The irony that this Western secular form of mindfulness, stripped of its Buddhist religious teachings, is now finding its way back to its source in Asia isn't lost on Professor Williams. But I was still having major problems bringing mindfulness into my life. I wondered if it was because I was trying to do it by myself at home in the dead of night, dog tired. Perhaps I needed the inspiration of people around me. It was time to take a class at the Mindfulness Project. Any preconceptions I may have had about mung bean munching, hemp-laden fashion and incense were completely dispelled when I arrived at this group's home in a Georgian terrace in one of London's smartest squares. Hello.
Hi.
I'm Emma.
I'm Alexa, and that's Autumn.
Alexa Frey from Switzerland, yes. And Autumn Torton from California started the project in 2013.
Wow, okay, this is beautiful. I was expecting
what did you expect?
I don't know, just very, very plain and white, but I would have imagined candles, I think.
Yeah, we decided not, because we're secular, so there are no Buddhas or incense or anything, but we do feel that candles are warm and give a nice calming atmosphere.
At the glamorous Mindfulness Project, where the walls are covered in beautiful pictures and mirrors, you can get everything from full retreats to courses in mindful photography, mindful eating, and even mindful wine tasting. Now we're talking.
If you want to have a look over the square, that's quite a nice view from up here. It's kind of, I don't know.
Do you encourage your students to have a look at the nice square when they're being mindful?
We love the big trees, because when the wind blows through them, sometimes we just listen to the trees, and they're so loud. Just mindfully listening to the trees, and it's really beautiful.
I will mindfully listen to the rustle of the trees as I leave, because okay. I didn't do that as I marched in off the back of a
tough
day.
Well, the wind's not really blowing. Oh, that's my gratitude alarm, sorry.
Don't worry. Your what? Your gratitude alarm?
Yeah, I set it every 2 hours. The alarm goes off, and I take 10 seconds to be grateful for something in my life, because Rick Hansen, he's kind of the biggest guy in the neuroscience of mindfulness at the moment. And he says it takes 10 seconds to hardwire your brain. So if you see something that you feel cool or, you know, you're grateful for, and if you don't spend 10 seconds feeling it and being with it, it doesn't get wired into your brain.
So hang on, that goes off not through your sleep?
No.
You don't wake up
again? No.
Ooh. I'm grateful.
No. I usually start like 2 p.m. and I might do like 3 of them each day.
Right, well, I knew I wasn't ready for a grateful alarm yet, so I settled for just getting a flavour of the Mindfulness Project's standard 8-week course and talking to some of those people who've been doing it for a while to see what I was missing.
So sitting in a comfortable position, closing your eyes, if that's comfortable.
Rebecca's a swimwear designer and Pat, a business manager for a telecoms company.
I had some anxiety for a short time, which I got some therapy for. And the therapist recommended just to sort of keep the whole theme of understanding how the mind works and stuff going for myself, that I took the mindfulness course.
And then has it helped so far?
Oh, yeah, massively. Yeah, massively. I mean, just it's the sort of thing you do and you think, you know, why haven't I done this sooner? I think one of the biggest things with mindfulness is that it teaches you that you don't have to engage with some of the thoughts you've got, things that aren't terribly positive sometimes.
How's it affected you so far, then?
We were just saying earlier, it's just really big impact on how to deal with anxiety. A lot of mine was kind of work-related.
Has it been better
Definitely,
since?
Yeah. It just helps you deal if you've got a stressful meeting coming up. And we've been taught special processes like the 3-step breathing rule and things like that to help you in stressful situations.
The possibility of stilling the mind and being able to keep calm even in the most stressful of situations is what's also attracting big businesses to mindfulness. Work-related stress is estimated to cost British companies more than £3 billion a year and $300 billion a year in America. The hidden costs are likely to be much higher as stressed workers struggle with concentration and effective decision-making. Google was one of the pioneers in bringing secular mindfulness-based stress reduction into the workplace, not only to deal with stress, but also to help the business. But mindfulness has even penetrated the much more hard-headed corporate world of the glass and steel canyons of Wall Street, and closer to home, the City of London. I've come to the offices of top international legal firm Ashurst, where staff are offered mindfulness courses during their lunch break. Can mindfulness really be translated from the cozy cushions and candles of places like the Mindfulness Project to the real-life typical office with noisy air conditioning?
We're going to do a mindfulness session today. Just to give you just a brief outline of the format, we're going to start with a three-step breathing practice, and we're going to have a brief discussion. And today's topic is around sounds and thoughts.
James Levy is a partner at Ashurst and a big fan of mindfulness.
I found it really very helpful. I think it's wonderful that there's a recognition that issues to do with mental resilience and how you feel while you're at work can affect the way you behave, how productive you are, how resilient you are. It's just acknowledging the reality of life in a city environment.
So what's been the effect for you at work?
It's been a way of freshening up the mind, pressing the reset button. People are paying us for our intellectual insights. And if those thoughts are getting cluttered by distractions, bad feelings, not being able to think straight, then seems to me that devices that help clear the mind are a good thing.
Joanne Gubby is the head of learning and development at Ashurst.
We are very keen to support our people in what is an increasingly demanding and high-pressure environment. Mindfulness is something that not only helps people manage stress, but it also helps them with focus, and that's actually what we were really interested in, giving them a strategy to help them be even more successful.
Are you actually hoping that this will help them do their jobs better, or is it more that you're trying to give them a better frame of mind generally?
I'm actually hoping for both. Everybody comes away saying they've got something out of it.
So is it a bit more zen here now?
I don't think it's ever going to be zen here, and that's not really what this is about.
The list of mainstream companies now offering mindfulness reads like a pension fund manager's portfolio. It's even made it onto the programme at the World Economic Forum in Davos. It feels like the tide of mindfulness has been unstoppable. Mindfulness has certainly come a long way and undergone a major transformation from its Buddhist roots to the secular stress reduction technique it is today. But there are those within the Buddhist community who are starting to raise concerns, who say in that journey to the West and to the ubiquity we see today, mindfulness has been hollowed out. It's become muck mindfulness. The term was coined by New York-based Buddhist psychotherapist Miles Neal. I asked him what he thought was missing in muck mindfulness.
What's overlooked when you abstract mindfulness from the psychology is that you miss a worldview or outlook, and you miss a set of ethical behaviors. So mindfulness is a practice of paying attention, and that's how it's built. It's very easily trainable. In a few sessions, you can teach someone to pay more attention. They can slow down. They can feel calmer. And by all means, as we're getting more stressed, that's a wonderful thing. But really, as it's taught in the traditional context, you also change your outlook. We went right for the technique. That's why if you give a corporate person a 10-minute break at lunch to do mindfulness, you're not really addressing the fact that he's going to work for 12 hours a day. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't address the corporate lifestyle of self-driven, motivated, and hungry to climb the ladder for your self-interest. You're not really thinking about the ripple effects of your actions. I mean, I live in New York City right now. Do you think there's anything called a 9-to-5 anymore? And then you give them 20 minutes of mindfulness, and with all the research out there, they get the inclination that if I do this, things will all be better. It's sold as a kind of panacea.
You know, the thing I feel slightly uncomfortable about, or maybe I don't feel like is realistic, that all of this is fine when you're living in a mountain, you know, a country that maybe has Buddhism at its core, but in America and in Britain, is it not slightly unrealistic to try and get everybody to ascribe to a worldview that doesn't fit in with the bigger view that they're in?
I think mindfulness is a band-aid, and I think we should be putting our heads together if we're really intelligent, careful, analytical, bright, intelligent people. We should be finding solutions, not just, you know, throwing up our hands and going, well, it's just kind of the way it is, and you Buddhists are really naive, you know, like you can live on a paradise and you're on your hill in the Himalayas and everything's fine for you, but not for us. I think that that's just a cop-out. I think we need to address the bigger issue. And I think that that's what the Buddha was doing at the time. He was a reactionary and a revolutionary, saying, hey, you know, you religious dogmas, you controlling society, we won't have this. He was trying to empower people to have a radical transformation, not so that they could sit in the corner and have, you know, a big smile on their face, but that they could collectively come back and change the fabric of society.
Buddhist psychotherapist Miles Neal, he doesn't mince his words. But criticism of mindfulness doesn't just come from within the Buddhist community. Melanie McDonough is a Catholic author and journalist.
I think that in the absence of organised religion, there is an absence of contemplative space. I think that people very rarely sit quietly, meditatively. But by its nature, it's narcissistic. You are focusing on yourself, you're focusing on your own body. There's nothing inherently harmful about that, but it's colossally limiting as a philosophy of life. And the other thing I find difficult about it is that it does seem to be commodifying the obvious. That is to say, you're charging, in some cases, quite a significant sum for getting people to sit in a quiet room and focus on their breathing. Pretty well any fool can do it, and in many cases, many fools do.
Professor Mark Williams, the clinical psychiatrist who's done so much to champion the use of secular mindfulness-based therapy in the UK, is much more optimistic.
I think it's very important to listen carefully to those who are part of the lineage of this ancient wisdom. I would say, however, that we're not actually teaching Buddhism. We're receiving important insights from Buddhist theories of mind and of the person and on their theory of how to liberate the mind from suffering. And what Buddhism has bequeathed us are extraordinary insights and hypotheses about how the mind works and what practices can liberate from suffering. One of the important things, however, and one of the really benefits of it becoming popular, is that those who really, really need it because they've had 3, 4, 5 episodes of crushing depression can now go to a mindfulness class without any stigma whatsoever. And the introduction into the corporate world is something which 20 years ago we'd have said, wouldn't that be a wonderful idea? Now that it has been introduced in the corporate world, people are sort of very worried about it and thinking that maybe the bosses are just manipulating their workers to be more productive. But I think if that's their intention, then they have to watch out, because one of the benefits of mindfulness is people seeing more clearly what's happening in their lives. So mindfulness could be quite subversive if they think it's going to just make everybody more compliant.
Andy Puddicombe is the co-founder of Headspace. So does the accusation of mindfulness upset him?
No, I kind of find it quite amusing. I think it could be taken kind of a bit too seriously. Look, everybody will have their view. The irony is that Buddhism is about embracing change. It's about recognizing impermanence and knowing that actually everything is always changing. And we're not living in the same world the Buddha was living in 2,500 years ago. And therefore, the teachings kind of need to change in some way as well. My teachers definitely embrace that, and I'm certainly very happy to be part of that myself.
There's another high-stress, goal-orientated environment that's starting to embrace mindfulness for employees, the military. The US Army is using it to prepare soldiers to deal with the stress both before and after deployments, and, as their website explains, for improving operational effectiveness and building warrior resilience. The first of the 5 precepts that make up the basic Buddhist moral code is that you should abstain from harming living beings. It's not hard to see why mindfulness in the military, even secular mindfulness, troubles many Buddhists. Professor Williams, co-founder of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, is much more pragmatic.
people who volunteer for the services are human beings too. So it would be extraordinary for us to say that mindfulness is for everybody in reducing stress, but don't offer it to the military. Why would we say that? It's not people in the army and the forces that actually send themselves into war. It's the politicians who send them to war. And we know that there's a great deal of stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. If that could be ameliorated or prevented in some way, then why not? So I think to say that some people somehow don't deserve it or that it would be dangerous to do it would be odd, I think.
So what does the future hold for mindfulness? The ever-increasing claims for it has also led to the halo effect of a bright spotlight being shone on the practice. Much of the early scientific research has been shown to be very poor quality, though more recent rigorous studies have backed it for treating people with depression and anxiety. But Christopher Titmus, one of Britain's most senior Buddhist teachers of mindfulness, believes the secular version doesn't just need to strengthen its empirical credentials. Unless it embraces an ethical vision, its appeal will start to wane.
The Buddha was asked, "What will destroy this world?" And he gave a one-word reply. He said, "Greed." And with so much exploitation taking place of people, of the workers, and our environment and resources, I think the Buddhist tradition genuinely has a voice to say, mindfulness has opened the door into the secular world, which is a great step forward. So many people are enthused by it, but it needs to have a vision to go with it, and if I may say here, much, much bigger. Otherwise, one of three things will happen. It will just be a hyped-up temporary fad. Second, it can remain more or less at its present level, which, frankly, I regard as a bit shallow. Or thirdly, it really shakes up society, and that would come through depth.
With those inspiring words ringing in my ear, it was time for me to go back and give mindfulness another try.
So I've had a week off mindfulness, which sounds a silly thing to say. And also, I should add, I'm doing this for the first time on a weekend. Lots of sunlight streaming in, so usually I've been doing this in the dead of night. And let's see how I feel.
Think of the mind as a still pool of water.
Well, the break certainly did me good, and I did feel more positive about that session. But was it the holiday or the mindfulness? I'm sorry to say I've been a bit of a failure when it comes to practicing mindfulness and getting my brain in gear. I did try, I promise. But I also came to realise that right now in my life, I don't feel I need it. And yet during the making of this programme, I've met a lot of people who've really been helped by mindfulness. Personally, when there are those times when I want to clear my mind, I'd rather go for a walk listening to a favourite podcast, have a whiskey with my friends, or take a nice long hot bath than sit still, meditating. As they say, other forms of relaxation are available. Now breathe deeply and relax, my friends, because this particular journey through mindfulness has come to an end.
Mindfulness was presented by Emma Barnett, and the producer was Phil Pegum.